This is Professor Allen, and welcome to the Quarter Bin. In almost every episode of this podcast, I summarize, criticize, discuss, and review a single issue from my comic book collection, which I select sort of at random. Any comic from my comic book collection would be eligible, long as I paid no more than 25 cents for it. But for this 30th episode of the Quarter Bin, I'm not looking at any particular comic. I'm going to have a conversation with a guest, Paul O'Connor. Welcome to the show, Paul.
Hello, Professor Allen. How you doing?
Great. Now, regular listeners to the Relatively Geeky Network are familiar with the name Paul O'Connor. Back in episode 16 of Shortbox Showcase, Emily and I used the March Madness sidekick rankings from Paul's excellent blog, Longbox Graveyard, as the jumping-off point for our sidekick discussion. And listeners of this podcast have heard the name Paul O'Connor a lot recently, because he scripted Rune 4 and Rune 5, the issues we covered the last two episodes. That's right! We have an actual former comic book professional on the show.
I am delighted to view myself as a former comic book professional. That's tremendous.
Now let's start at the blog, Longbox Graveyard. That's how we came to know each other maybe 18 months ago. Or what was the thinking in general behind blogging? And then explain the specific niche of the graveyard and what are people likely to find when they visit?
Well, thank you for that. The blog is www.longboxgraveyard.com. I started it 3 years ago because I was forced to confront that I didn't have a comics collection. What I had was a comic book accumulation, a big pile of comics that I'd been piling up in my garage since buying my first comic when I was a kid in 1974. They were all stored in boxes, but I had no idea where anything was. I couldn't lay my hands on anything. And I'd gone to the movies with my son, Jack, and we just saw the first Thor picture. Have any Thor comics?
Maybe somewhere?
Yeah. Maybe we should drop by Barnes & Noble and pick up a collection, because I can't find them. And I thought, well, that's a shame, because 20-odd long boxes that I had. But at the same time, I couldn't. So I decided, well, I need to bite off this project. I need to go through and organize things, find out what I have, get it bagged and boarded, get it all cataloged. I had these ambitions, but I thought, well, how can I stay track? So I thought, well, if I write a blog about it, that will keep me accountable. And I really just thought it would be for my own purposes. Because, you know, anything we're doing is worth overdoing. I thought, well, what the heck? I'll learn about blogging at the same time, or try to. It and expand my knowledge of social media, et cetera, and just put the blog out there and see if there are readers. And surprisingly, there were readers, and the blog has now grown. As I mentioned, it's going into its fourth year. I have a small but dedicated readership, and it's been a real delight to learn about that community and make some new friends and also come to a renewed appreciation for comics.
Now, of course, being a comic book guy myself, with all of the character flaws that implies... When I found your blog, I started at the beginning and started working my way through, of course. You even referenced your past blog posts as the checklist.
Yes.
I think is perfect. So I went through entry by entry, and that actually took a while because there are some long essays on that blog. Was that something that just happened, or was sort of that long essay-like blog post part of the plan, or was there a plan?
Well, there certainly was no plan. The length of the blogs is just... You know, I'm Irish. I can't shut up. I go on a length. And no one told me that blogs are supposed to be short. I mean, now this new trend in blogs is the long read. Anything over 1,500 words, I guess, is a long read. And I kind of always did that. I guess I just have a lot to say about things. And, you know, for the first year or so, I published once a week, you know, and I appreciate you slogging through the whole back catalog. That's crazy. And since then, I've ramped back a little bit. But that... It's free. It's free for me. It's free for you. And I certainly don't expect people to read every word. I'm sure there's a healthy amount of scrolling that goes on. And I try to throw enough images in there that the blog is at least visually arresting, even if you skip over some of the words. But I'm very flattered that you read not one, but all of my entries, Professor Allen. That's tremendous. Thank you.
Now, you had mentioned the social media. Think of the comic book blogs that I follow. You do one of the best jobs with that. Now, I'm not the only one who thinks so, because your Pinterest presence has been recognized.
Yes.
What has your overall strategy been on that, again, if there was a strategy, on using the social media in your blogging, and specifically Pinterest, because we're not the stereotypical demographic?
It's true. for a long time, my call to action was to join me in my one geek war against handbags and hairstyles on Pinterest. Because Pinterest is a very female skewing site, and God bless them, we could use more of that, especially in our geek world, which is can still be a bit of a boys' club.
Yes.
My approach to social media was just as scattershot as anything else in creation of the blog. In my secret identity, I'm a partner in an iPhone development company called Appy Entertainment, and among my responsibilities there was running our social media. And that just meant having a Twitter account and maintaining the Facebook page and updating a blog on that side every once in a while. So I'd gotten my feet wet with it a little bit. But in my capacity as the brand manager for Appy, I had to speak on behalf of the company, however small. Whereas with Longbox Graveyard, it could just be me. There was, you know, I wasn't going to damage a future acquisition opportunity for my enterprise. I'm saying the wrong thing.
Lower stakes, so, less risk.
That's right. So with the social media on Longback side, I just kind of cut loose a little bit and was more willing to experiment with things, more willing to make a fool of myself, you know, even more so than usual. So I just tried a lot of stuff. And for the first couple years in at Longbox Graveyard, my unofficial motto was say yes to everything. So if someone wanted me to start a podcast, yeah, I'll do that. If someone wanted me to guest blog for them, sure, I'll do that. If someone wanted me to, you know, try out this new social media network, yeah, I'd do that too. And going back to Pinterest, one of the things that came to my attention specifically because my niece loved it. And I just, my antenna went up because she was talking about Pinterest and I hadn't heard of it. And I was supposedly a social media expert. So I thought, well, I'll go check it out. So I got on it very early. And like anybody else, didn't really understand what it was. But because it was visual, it dovetailed with comics in an interesting way. And I used it to start storing the comic book images that were being posted at my blog anyway. I'd like to have an opportunity to post to the blog several times a week. So it was easy content on a Thursday or whatever to just put up a link to a Pinterest gallery that I'd already established it would be of interest to Longbox Graveyard readers. So today, for instance, at Longbox Graveyard, as we record this, I just put up a link to a Pinterest gallery. It's all Captain America images from Jack Kirby. It's just 15, 20 images. It's kind of cool. You can check them out. And where it got kind of strange is that Pinterest took notice of me. I'm still not sure how that happened, but I got an email one day from Pinterest saying, hey, we want to do a blog about you and post it to our board. So, well, okay, sure. And they were specifically the same thing. It's because I just was kind of an outlier with my interest in comics and that I had a Y chromosome, I guess. So I did a little interview with them. And then, of course, you promote that back, you know, to your own blog, and then you put it out on your Twitter, and everything just sort of escalates from there. And then a few weeks later, I got an email from a reporter over at Digiday who wanted to follow up on that article about, you know, men on Pinterest. And he was interviewing everybody that he could find that was, you know, that would be of interest to that story. So we talked for a little bit and I was just part of a general interest article. And then he did a follow up a couple weeks later. And that's where it got a little peculiar because he was following up on the Pinterest story and he'd gotten access to some analytics through Pinterest that by some kind of crazy gerrymandering of statistics, I was somehow the fifth most influential male on Pinterest in the planet. Which is, as I said at the time, if someone can help me figure out how to cash that check, I'm all here. So I was, okay, so I'm the fifth most Pinteresting man in the world is what I said, and I posted a blog about that as well. Then I, you know, they bought me free drinks at WonderCon that weekend because I was a minor celebrity. So there you go. That's the thing about the social media is you don't know where it's going to lead. Well, right. I can almost guarantee where it's going to lead. It's going to lead nowhere. It's going to lead to a place really silly. But as long as you have fun doing it and it can help you meet people, then who knows what possibilities may yet emerge.
That idea of saying yes to every opportunity is a good strategy for, you know, 6 months maybe.
Yeah.
maybe a New Year's resolution, but more than that, you just get more stuff on your plate than you can handle, I imagine. And you mentioned podcasting, and you did what I thought was a really solid, I like to think of it now as a 12-episode mini-series of podcasting. How did you get into that? Those episodes are still available on the blog, I take it.
Yes, they are. The Longbox Graveyard Podcast, you're right. It was 12 episodes. It was a monthly production. You're right. If you say yes to everything, you will eventually burn out. And that's one of the reasons I did bring the podcast to a close after 12 episodes is because I felt that I was flirting with burnout. And I didn't want that to impact the work or to impact my joy that I was taking in the work. But I was really happy to do the podcast. I have an interest in radio. So podcasting is a close walk from radio, and I actually did a little bit of radio work as a younger person, some guest spots, and very nearly was a DJ at one point. So it's sort of a path not taken. I thought, okay, well, let's try this podcasting thing. And but again, it was something where I didn't bring it up. I had been a guest on a couple podcasts. There's a show called We Talk Comics, done by some Canadian friends of mine, and they'd seen me ranting about something, digital comics or something. So they come on to the show and talk about it. It's fine. So I did that. You know, I guess they found that I was prepared and had a good voice, could talk off the cuff, and they thought the guy that ran the podcast, Mo Christensen, specifically wrote to me and said, "Hey, you should do a podcast. We should do a podcast together. Let's do it." And he said, "I'll set it up for you. You just send me the files, and I'll engineer it, and I'll post it, and we'll give you the ad revenue if there is any." And there never was any, but that's fine.
It's still hard to beat an offer like that, though.
Yeah, I say yes to everything, right? It was very flattering. He had no real requirements. He said, "Well, we can do it as a partnership, or you can do it as a monologue or whatever." And I thought about it for a while, and I came up with a format, and I thought, well, it could be kind of an adjunct to what I was doing with the blog. So yeah, what the heck, let's do it. And it started off as just a monthly podcast. Sometimes I'd anchor it by myself. Sometimes I'd have a friend in. But by the time that year was winding down, it was obvious to me that as much as I was enjoying the podcast, it wasn't where most of my passion lay. So I wanted to bring it to a conclusion. And in fact, Professor Allen, I think you had something to do with my deciding to end the podcast.
Oh,
you don't know,
man. I'm going to cry.
Yeah, because I appreciate that you're such a fan of the podcast. But reading your blog, right, you would occasionally lament that a podcast that you enjoyed would just disappear. Pod faded may have even been the word that you used.
That sounds right.
And you're saying, geez, it's you form a relationship with people when they're podcasting, and then you realize that you haven't heard one for a couple months, and the podcast just sort of went away, and you wonder what happened. And I thought, you know what, that's not going to happen with the Long Box Graveyard podcast. If I'm going to end it, I'm going to end it with intentionality, and I'm going to explain to people why it is. So I knew, and I told Mo ahead of time, and I knew, you know, when I was doing the 10th, 11th podcast that it was going to be over, and that allowed me to bring it to a conclusion. That for me was a good thing, because it allowed me to feel like, okay, 12 is a good number. I did it for a year. I kind of understand what it's about. I can come back to it later if I want, but this is a good place to tie it off. So it was the combination of overextending myself a little bit, discovering my passions weren't quite aligned with the requirements of podcasting, that magic number of 12, and Professor Allen whispering in my ear, "Don't fade away. Don't fade away." That's what brought the podcast to a conclusion.
Oh, man. Now I feel bad. Most of your time into blogging, like I said, I started at the beginning. It actually took me a while to learn that you had this secret history, secret shame as a comic book writer. Now, yeah, if I were doing a comic book blog and had that on my resume, maybe I'd mention it sooner than you did, a little geek cred and all that. Again, sort of, what was that? Was that a specific choice, or did it just sort of happen that way, that 30 blog posts or something like that, till sort of this subtly came up?
Well, the blog was never about me. It was about comics and my life. And in that sense, it was more about the influence comics had on me. And that meant that I wanted to look more at the books that I read when I was 12, 13, 14, 18 years old, and really had my mind shaped by these crazy things. That was the focus, more than that I went on and wrote them myself for a relatively brief time. I was only a comic writer for 3-4 years. I didn't publish more than 50, 60 books. The other thing is that I wasn't very successful as a comic book writer. And when I began the blog, that kind of hung over me. In a sense, that was as much a burden to me as was these 5,000 comic books that were just all tumbled up in the garage. There was a sense of, I failed myself, or there was a sense of, this was a path I didn't take, or at the very least, there was a sense of, geez, these were, you know, 3-4 years of rolling rocks up hills, and I didn't get anything out of it. So I wasn't ashamed of the work or having done it, but I wasn't really at peace with it either. And I hadn't read my own comics for 20 years. I hadn't looked at them. They'd all been locked away in a box. Occasionally, I'd do a little Pandora peek just to make sure they were still in there. But I deliberately turned my back on comics and was doing other things creatively in my life. So, I don't know. It was sort of a void or a little itch that needed to be scratched there eventually. So, just sort of in the flow, in the context of going through that comic accumulation and pulling out books and saying, oh, here's Micronauts. Was it good or not? Here's Walt Simonson's run on Thor. Was it as good as I remembered? Eventually, in that stack, you come to books that I wrote. And I was like, okay, well, it's time to confront these. And that's when I started to talk about them in the context of the blog.
At about what point in your childhood or adolescence did you start storytelling? Were you always, a creative person, always a writer?
I guess I was. I perceived that through the reflection of people's expectations more than through my own achievement. I was supported by parents, by brothers that thought that I had artistic gifts and were always encouraging that. So I remember expectations from an early age about, oh yeah, you're gonna do something. But I didn't necessarily do those things. So, yeah, my father was an artistic guy, but he was also a very pragmatic guy. So he would sculpt and he'd lay bricks, and laying bricks made the money,
Sure.
So I think I imprinted on the idea that you got to lay the bricks. And as a consequence, never really pursued creativity for its own sake. And in a sense, when I had the opportunity to write comics with Malibu starting in 1989, I'm bricklaying. Because, I looked at the writers that I most admired at that time were the pulp authors. I'd look at guys like Robert E. Howard or Maxwell Grant or Lester Dent, that had written Conan or The Shadow or Doc Savage, and said, well, man, those guys had an enormous page rate and we're still reading their books centuries later or, decades later. That was my romantic image of what a writer was. I wasn't imprinting on Hemingway. I was imprinting on some ink-stained wretch that was writing Blood and Thunder. And I thought, okay, that's what I'll do. When I had the opportunity to write comics, that's because the commercial aspect of it was there. That's what kind of fired me up as a writer. And I've, one way or the other, I've continued to make my way as a writer since then. But I've gone into the video game business, and most of the work I do is game documentation or pitch documents or, social media things or promotion, publicity to support game releases. So perhaps I've misused my gifts. But I have two boys now, two teenage boys that are both writers. One's writing novels, the other's writing screenplays. So they're both ambitious to do that as their vocation. So if it skips a generation, or if my job was to raise better writers than I, that's fine. And life is long, and maybe there's writing for me in the future yet.
Everybody's story is a little bit different. What was your process for pursuing comic book writing, or how did you end up doing that for those few years that you were?
End up is a great way to describe it.
I was going to say fall into it, but that just seemed impolite.
Back into it, maybe? Well, I got into comics in the time-honored fashion of having a friend hire me. I mean, it's no different at Marvel or DC. To be a buddy with an editor is the best way to get a job. So what happened was Malibu Comics was one of these publishers that grew out of the direct market boom of the late 80s, early 90s, specifically the black and white comics boom. Scott Rosenberg, who ran a comic book distributor called Sunrise Distribution, had bought up a couple smaller comic book companies, and he wanted to form a new publisher called Malibu Comics, which would be unique, for one thing, because it would be on the West Coast. Most publishing was East Coast at that point.
Right.
But specifically, it was going to be, hey, we're going to publish black and white comics, and he has a distribution arm, and you're basically printing money at this point because of the way the system was set up. He put together an editorial staff that consisted of Tom Mason and Dave Olbrich, who'd both come out of Fantagraphics, I think, as editor-in-chief, my friend Chris Ulm. Now, Chris, he was actually working for Sunrise Distribution on the game side of things, distributing war games, role-playing games, that kind of thing. But he had an interest in comics, so did I. Chris and I have been friends for a couple years. Chris's ears perked up when he heard they were putting together a comic book publishing operation. He sort of drifted over to that side of the warehouse and found himself, in the band. So, for better or worse, a new comic book company was born. It was called Malibu, and they needed content. And so everybody just reached out to their network of contacts. And Dave and Tom knew lots of guys because they'd been in the business forever. But Chris, was like, who was he going to throw at him? Well, I was one of the guys. So I went down to Sunrise for the day and talked with Chris and Tom Mason and pitched them a couple ideas, and they took two of them. And just like that, I was in the comic book business. Now, I didn't know what to do. Arguably, I never figured it out. But certainly at that time, I didn't know what to do. I didn't know how to write a comic script. There's no reference. There's no internet. You couldn't go to a store and buy a book on comic book scripting. Mm. You could kind of look at screenplays, but it wasn't exactly the same. I think I dug up an example through Fan Magazine of the Marvel style, which was write a plot synopsis and then let a penciler do the storytelling, and then you add script to it. But I wasn't really comfortable working that way because I just felt like I had a story to tell. And I wrote it kind of like a screenplay. Wrote full script is the format you would call it, I guess. The great thing about writing comics was that, I was I loved comics, of course. So there was, to some extent, I felt like I succeeded at something. I fulfilled a dream. It would have been more fulfilling if I was writing comic book characters at Marvel or DC, because that's what I loved as a kid. But I was, at least I was in the business. But really what was more attractive was just this idea, son of a gun, you know, I'm supporting myself with my writing. And it was, I wasn't paid a lot. I got it. I eventually got it down to the point where I could finish 8 pages a day. It was kind of my goal, which would mean I'd finish a 24-page comic in 3 days. And my advance for a 24-page comic, I think, was $300. And if I could do 4 of those a month, I could kind of make my rent and keep going. That's, you know, that's what I did for 2-3 years. And I mean, nothing survives from it, of the work, aside from the comics we're going to talk about today, which is great. But I mean, it didn't evolve into a writing job for me, but it did tell me, it did teach me a lot about the discipline of sitting down in front of your, at first a typewriter, but, you know, very quickly a computer to do your work. And also just to learn the rhythms of being a writer on a daily basis. Sometimes you sit down and you're on fire and it comes easy. And sometimes you sit down and the beads of blood form on your forehead. Or sometimes you get to the end of your 8 pages and you think they're crap. And then the next day you sit down, you read them and go, that's not crap. That's actually pretty good. What was I thinking? Or vice versa. I thought this was really hot and instead it doesn't work. And I was able to experience that at a, you know, as a young man working on, amazingly, I took it for granted at the time, working on my own ideas, really, for the most part. I ended up taking inventory work later in my career, such as it was. But at the beginning, I was doing original properties, my own ideas. So I was learning how to pitch ideas, how to craft them, how to write. The things I didn't learn that I regret, I didn't learn much about the networking side or you know, the ability, how to continue to work as a writer and get additional assignments. And I also didn't learn much about the craft of writing comics specifically. I look back at some of the scripts I submitted to my poor pencilers, and I wonder that they didn't track me down and kill me, because comics are a very specific discipline. I didn't understand at the time how incumbent it is upon you as a writer to think visually and to partner with your artist to tell the story in a collaborative fashion. And more often than not, I was writing stories that maybe better suited to being short stories or novels or screenplays or teleplays or something, and then sort of throwing them over the wall to a hapless penciler that would be well out of their depth in terms of communicating the things I put into the script.
Now, you've maintained that friendship with a lot of that Malibu crew, including Chris, your editor on the books, has collaborated both on the blog and on a couple of those podcast episodes, if I remember. And weren't you involved in putting together or organizing a Malibu reunion a couple of years ago?
Glad you brought that up. Probably the greatest legacy of my comic book career was the friendships I made, specifically with the Malibu guys, with Chris Ulm, who's been my creative partner for, you know, 25 years. We're partners in a business to this day. My desk is directly across from his. I see him every day at work. And also Tom Mason, who I don't see every day, but I send him email every day. Dave Ulbricht, still very close with. I see him a couple times a year. He's down for dinner. We always see each other at the shows. So yeah, I remain tight with those guys. We became lifelong friends, and you know, some of them have gone on to jobs, other jobs in the comic business or the, you know, whatever. But it's always kind of old home week when we get together. Part of, you know, in my first year with Longbox Graveyard, Say Yes to Everything was this idea. Well, WonderCon is asking for panel presentations. I'd done public speaking before on my video game side. I've spoken at GDC, I've spoken in China, United States, all these different conferences. So being on panels was no issue. And I thought, well, why don't I throw together a panel for WonderCon or for Comic-Con and see what that's about? I contacted the guys. I said, you know, you got this anniversary coming up for Malibu. It's been whatever it was, you know, 20, 25 years, or Ultraverse was an anniversary. I forget what it was. We had some thin excuse. Let's just get together on a panel and talk about what Malibu was like. So we did that. You know, I scratched that off my bucket list. I put together a panel and I hosted it at WonderCon, and it was fun. And it's gratifying for the guys too, because they see people turn out that remember their work and, you know, remember things that they don't. And you find out that you touch people in ways you don't anticipate. And that ultimately is your reward for being a creator, because, you know, the money fades away. There was never that much money to begin with. And it's not really glory, but it's rewarding to know that, you know, people remember what you did and that they enjoyed it, that it meant something to them. That's always nice.
The premise of this podcast is about talking about books that I find in the cheap bins. And the 90s have contributed many, many books to the cheapest of those bins, including a lot from obviously Marvel and DC and from every other independent and, you know, third-party publisher you could find. But of all those independent or alternative lines, the Malibu and the Ultraverse in particular seem to have stood the test of time in terms of fans, and that's probably a little bit of what you experienced at that panel.
I think you're right. I mean, talk about say yes to everything. That was Malibu, really. Because Malibu was just based on, I mean, that's the one thing they really understood was their cash flow. They knew, okay, we got to make this much money by this date to pay the publisher so we can print more books so we can stay in business for another month. And, you know, there were several times that they thought they were finished, probably seven or eight times at least that, you know, Chris and I had discussed where they're just convinced, okay, Monday we're out of business, we're laying people off, you know, but they always found a way to make ends meet. Because they were so in such a scramble all the time, they had to use every part of the Buffalo. And that means they did every kind of comic under the sun. They did right. Superhero books. They did pulp. They did science fiction. They did horror. They did color. They did black and white. Really throw it at the wall and see what sticks. And I guess with that kind of Jackson Pollock approach to publishing, you're going to come up with some combinations that people are going to remember. Believe me, there's a lot of Malibu stuff that it's not as especially esteemable or that people are nostalgic for. But the other thing that Malibu did, partly out of necessity, but also out of just their own ethos, and this came mostly from Dave and Tom, is that they strove to break new people into the business, myself included, but several other, you know, guys that are big pros now started with Malibu. And they also had a very pro-creator rights stance.
Right.
In that their contracts were written so that it was a partnership with the creators, and the creators owned their properties going forward. Famously, Men in Black was a Malibu Comics publication, and Lowell Cunningham benefited from that when that property was picked up and made into a film. They were very progressive in that sense as well, and that allowed them to attract people that were not just looking to make a living, but were also interested in telling the stories that they'd carried around with themselves for years. Especially in the case of the Ultraverse guys at the end, guys like Steve Englehart and Mike Barr that had been writers at the Big Two for years but had stories that they wanted to tell that they didn't want to give to Marvel or DC because they couldn't own that work. Well, now they could come to Malibu and they could tell those stories. So I think that more than anything else, the work was heartfelt. It wasn't always good, but it was almost always heartfelt, and very rarely was it ground out. I mean, let's be serious. Almost every ill of the comic book business now, you can trace back to Malibu Comics. you can specifically trace it back to Tom Mason's desk, and Tom would laugh hysterically if he heard me say this, so I don't mind saying it. And Tom's the guy that let the cat out of the bag. I mean, if not for Tom, we probably wouldn't have a business that was as driven by editorial event crossovers or chromium covers or polybag gimmick presentations or the death of major characters, the resurrection.
I mean, no, because I used to like you, Paul. Until this. Now it's all coming clear.
The playbook for modern comic publication distribution was set up at Malibu Comics in the early 1990s because they had to figure stuff out to stay in business. And one of the insights that Tom had was the customer of comic books is not the reader. The customer of comic books is the retailer. And it doesn't sound like that big a difference, but it's a huge difference about the way you run your business. And what Tom realized was, you know, the important thing is the way we position our properties in diamond previews to ensure that the retailer is going to buy five copies of something instead of three. And that's our margin. That's the difference between staying in business and going out of business. They buy five copies instead of three, spread over 3,000 stores, we're in the black. If not, we're finished. So with that recognition, you start sculpting your product and your pitches towards what will excite a retailer's attention, maybe spending more on a cover than you would on the interior. And it also means gimmicks. What sells best? Number one sell best. Okay, we'll cancel the series with issue number three and start over again with number one. and it worked. So when you do that and your sales go up, you're going to continue to do it and you wind up with the business that you deserve because it's not sustainable. Talk about being ahead of your time. There was a point where I came to Malibu and argued that we should number our comics backwards. Now this is arguably
sorry, didn't mean to laugh at this brilliant idea.
I'm used to it. People have been laughing at me like this for 25 years, but I think probably the time has come. Indulge me for a second. If we know that your issue number one is going to sell more copies than anything else, then your sales is going to drop off 30% to number two, be 70% by number three, and if you get to number six, you're canceled. So you're probably going to reboot after four issues. My point was come out with issue number four first, and then go to three, go to two, go to one. The idea is twofold. One is that because the numbers are getting lower, A, it would drive people crazy, and we'd get some publicity out of that. B, you wouldn't tell the story backwards or anything. You'd tell it forwards. You'd just number it backwards. By virtue of just a person picking it off the shelf, they'd see that lower number and think it was a more important issue and be more likely just to pick it up. But also implicit in this is, you know what? We're going to finish this story. And this is where I think
that's the part that I appreciate.
Yeah, I'm going to finish this story, and you know when it's going to end. Right, I can look at this, it's four issues. Now, you can say, you know, number one in a four issue miniseries or whatever, but I've seen miniseries canceled. I've written miniseries that have been canceled. Right? So there's no guarantee that you're going to get to the end of that fourth issue. But if it's number four out of four, and then it's number three out of four, two out of four, one out of four, you know you're going to complete the story. So look, it's probably a totally stupid idea. Pretty much the only idea they didn't try at Malibu over the course of their existence. And like I said, all those crazy promotional ideas, they've been cherry-picked by the big two. And now, for better or worse, that's the business we have. It's all republications, reboots, gimmicks. You can lay that corpse at the step of Malibu Comics.
But you know what else is a stupid idea? Decimal numbers and zeros. So yeah. At least that part of your plan, your master plan...
I don't think we did that, but they must have done an issue number zero at some point. I'm sure they did number zeros by the time Ultraverse came around, but I wasn't a full-time writer by the time Ultraverse launched. I caught on at the very end with those Rune books, but that was it.
Well, let's take a break, put in a promo here, and when we come back, we will talk about Rune 4 and Rune 5.
The radio station in Chester's Mill may have burned down, but you can still hear hits like...
And they're still having fun. Chester's Mill's the one.
And...
Splish Splash the Egg was taking a bath deep below a methane-filled lake. Rub-a-dub, let's have Julia didn't flub, making this decision in haste.
All thanks to Under the Dome Radio. This summer, Troy and Wayne return to discuss what happened when we were
blinded by the light, wrapped up in the noose as the dome it turned to white. Blinded by the light, holding on to a lever as the dome it turned to white.
Be sure to set the dial of your podcasting app to Under the Dome Radio and keep the propane donations flowing at
Under the Dome Radio.
A proud member of the Noodle Mix Network.
And we're back. When I went to my comic book store for its regular quarter bin sale last May, I wasn't planning on doing the quarter bin podcast back then, but I was gathering up cheap comics because, you know, I like cheap comics. Found a bunch of Malibu Ultraverse and knew that my internet buddy Paul O'Connor had written a few Malibu Ultraverse titles. And bam, there they were, Rune 4 and Rune 5. And I was excited with my find, Paul, but I was a little hesitant to tweet about it to let you know because I didn't know how you'd feel about the 25-cent price tag on your work.
I think you got ripped off. Well, no, actually, that's quite a deal. I'm looking at the issues right now, and they were $1.50, actually, which is pretty pricey for that particular era. So at a quarter, I think you did okay.
Now, you mentioned that you had an experience once of seeing a copy of your book at a dollar.
Kinda. This is when I was still actively working as a comic book writer, and things weren't going very well. I wasn't getting many assignments. I was having a hard time selling original ideas. And I was out for the afternoon, was exploring a place called the Golden Mall, a stretch of old used paperback stores, movie memorabilia stores, that kind of thing. And I always liked wandering around there because it reminded me of Hollywood Boulevard when I was a kid. I walked past one anonymous store, and in the window, they had comic books. And I stopped dead on my track because I think there were maybe 8 books in the window, and 5 of them were mine. 5 of them were books that I had written. And the other 2 or 3 were Malibu's. And I thought...
Score! Man, oh man! Doesn't get any better than this.
I found my people, right? They put me in the window. Well, that's a little validation. I'm on the right path. I'm a creator. So I went into the comic shop, you know, the big old smile on my face, thinking, well, they're going to recognize me. I drop the confetti as soon as I come in. And I wander around the store a little bit to find the comic section. And they had back issues for sale and the usual stuff. And I was like, oh, where's my comics? You know, as they have me out here in this display. And I hunted for a bit. And finally, I found my comics. And I found the Malibu books, and they're all in a box, and they're all in basically quarter box.
And at all at once, I had this crushing realization. Felt like a fool because I realized, oh, the reason my comics are in the window is not because they hold my comics in great esteem. The reason my comics are in the window is because they're not worth anything. And they can staple them to their display in the window where the sunlight can hit them and leach all the color off the covers, and they're not losing any money. But what they're saying to the prospective guy walking by on the street is, look, there's comics. Come on in.
To be fair, with that Malibu coloring process, it was going to take a lot of sun to really start to fade, though. So that was part of the calculus, I'm sure, as well.
For a moment there, I felt a little low, right? Because I thought, okay, that's a good one. That's a nice little joke that the universe is having at my expense. But I turned around, and I looked at the rest of the store. And as far as my eye could see, marching away row upon row were books. Book after book after book. Romance, fiction, nonfiction, people's lives' works, their theories, their treatises, their passions poured out on these pages, all sitting on shelves in the same bookstore, all for a dollar or two. And I thought, you know what? I'm in pretty good company.
Exactly.
I think that was kind of my realization that there's what something is worth and there's what something costs. And it's not the same. Hmm. That my work is in a dollar box someplace or a quarter box someplace, I totally get it and I totally understand why. I understand the way the market works. And it doesn't diminish for a second the value of the work that I did. But it took me a long time to come around to that understanding.
Sure.
And having that sort of epiphany helped me a little, but it really didn't. The lessons didn't really get locked in until I started this long box graveyard and really came to terms with what my time in the business had meant.
Right. Now, looking at these books in particular, from a reader's perspective, it seems to me that Rune would be a tough character to write. He's the title character of the book, the protagonist, but not exactly classically heroic. Do you remember your initial take on the character?
My initial take was copy Marv Wolfman's Tomb of Dracula. And I love Tomb of Dracula. I think it's one of the great long runs from the 1970s. It's one of the great comics of all time. What Marv and Gene Colan and Tom Palmer did in that book was they laid down the DNA for doing antiheroes in comic books.
Right.
Because Dracula is a bad dude. But they find things about him that are heroic or at least interesting. And then they surround him with a group of characters that are alternatively a lot worse than he is or more heroic than he is. Right. So there's always something for everybody. That gave me a place to start, but it didn't give me a real blueprint because I didn't have the luxury of 50 issues to explore this character. I had two issues. It was a fill-in story, it was an inventory story. But I was eager to write Rune because I like the bad guys. I like the anti-heroes. You know, Rune is the baddest of the bad guys in the Ultraverse. He's one of the most violent, evil main characters I think comics have ever seen. I attack that with relish, believe me.
Well, my favorite comic book character of all time is Dr. Doom, so I feel your brother.
Yeah, well, I think Dr. Doom is, he looks like Romper Room next to Room.
As you mentioned, this was a fill-in or inventory story, so you know, the first two pages of the first book and the last two pages of the last book were in current day, and your story sort of served as a flashback of sorts. And
yeah.
So with that, how much freedom did you have in picking a time frame, a setting, a story, that sort of thing?
Well, quite a bit. I wrote two inventory stories for Ultraverse. Only one of them was published. That was this one here in issues 4 and 5 of Rune. I also wrote a single issue inventory story for Sludge under Steve Gerber's tutelage, which was a great experience, but that book was never published. And Steve, bless him, he was up my backside with with the mining lantern in terms of the direction he gave me on putting together that story. Rune was a little looser. Rune was originally created by Chris Holm, my good friend, of course, and Barry Windsor-Smith, one of the legitimate geniuses of our form. The first run of Rune was Chris more or less trying to corral Barry and figure out how to work with this guy who was so good, but, you know, very particular. And I think, you know, he learned a lot from that relationship too. But the ship had kind of sailed on Rune. You know, the first, whatever it was, 8-10 issues or so that they did in the original iteration of the Ultraverse, that story had kind of come and gone, and Barry had moved on, and Chris had taken his hands off the book, and it was just another book in the line at this point. Len Kaminsky was writing it. He was one of the Ultraverse stalwarts. And it's like, okay, well, just with a fill-in issue, you want to have them written and drawn and have them in the file. So if you run into a deadline problem, you can just run them. So I wrote these issues, and then they sat in the file for a while before they were actually placed into continuity. I did specifically decide to set the story in the past. And I think it was because of my experience writing that sludge story for Steve. You know, he was so concerned that about the continuity of the character and the way all the pieces fit together. I thought, you know, I got to carve out a little section for myself with Rune where it's not going to step on anybody's toes. And also, the thing was, the story could run at any time. I didn't know where it was going to fit into their plans. So naturally, with a character, an immortal character, a vampire lord like Rune, I was able to, well, you know, I can set the story in the past. And I had an interest in the era. There's a book called A Distant Mirror by Barbara Tuchman. The subtitle is The Calamitous 14th Century. And I'd read this book in my 20s, and it deeply impressed me as a chronicle of what it was like to be alive in Europe during the Black Plague. It was so vivid. The people of the time were so convinced that they were facing end times, that the apocalypse was upon them. And I thought, what better place for our friend Rune to show up? Because it goes back to that Marv Wolfman playbook with Tomb of Dracula. You make Dracula interesting because he's up against guys that are a lot worse. So Rune is a terrible person. He's a murderer. He's a vampire. But he's going to be, I decided I'd make him the lord of this little medieval town, and he would protect them against the plague and against the marauding soldiers of 14th century Europe. And as horrible as he is, his people would look to him as a savior because he has wisdom and he has strength. So then it was a happy accident. It's like, okay, well, I can set the story in the past. I have a theme I want to explore. I have some historical data that I can leverage to develop my story. And I pitched it on that basis. They said, yeah, go for it. And then it was also unique as inventory stories are concerned. And then I got two issues out of it. 24 pages is, it's hard to do much of a story in comics in 24 pages. I say that knowing that, you know, you can read 8 pages of The Spirit from Will Eisner and it's greater than, you know, than any 80 pages that someone else might do. But for me, it's really hard to do a story in less than 48 pages or so. That gives you some room to explore some themes and have act breaks and do the things that I think you need to do. So getting those two issues together was, yeah, go for it. And I had to carve a couple of pages off for the rapper pieces that Len was going to write, but I had a good, 45 pages or so to write, and I went for it.
I love the way that the first story begins with that illuminated manuscript page. Sort of, at what point do you remember locking into that? I thought that was just a great way to set the scene as saying, this is different.
I mentioned earlier, you know, in our past conversation, I told you that one of my failings I felt as a comic book writer was not thinking visually. I am proud that I thought of that, right, and used it here because it's also a way that to tell a story that really only comics can do. So yeah, I mean, page one of the script, you go look at it, you know, the scripts are online. You go to my blog, go to Longbox Graveyard, and there's a tab, a page off the front page. You can find a little button that says scripts, and you hit that, and you can drill down into it. And both the scripts for both these issues of Rune are there in their original format. And you'll see I describe it exactly like that, saying, look, let's do it like an illuminated manuscript, and let's use the lettering a certain way. Because it was necessary to quickly establish for the readers what world we were in and how it was different. And a lot of the text that I use in there came out of this Tuchman book, you know, the description of the Black Plague, about how rapidly it killed people, about it seeming like, these pustules like brittle black sea coral, I think was the line I used. That was from a monk of the era describing a firsthand experience and seeing the Black Plague. And that was just such good stuff. I wanted to get it in there. So that's how we started. That's how we set the scene.
A listener to the podcast know that I'm interested in theology and religion and church history. And so any time religious content or imagery appears in a comic story, I certainly notice it. And I was wondering if that was something in particular you're going for, or is it just if you're writing about Europe in the 1300s, not including the cultural influence of the church didn't make any sense?
Yeah, mostly the latter. You know, our modern perspective about a separation of church and state has no analog in medieval Europe, a totally alien concept. Church and state are one. So if you're going to write a story set in that environment, psychologically, I think you need to accommodate that. Personally, I'm not a person of any particular faith, but I am a student of history, and I have read the Bible, and I do recognize its importance to that era. So it was a critical component of the story from the very beginning. And also, I was interested in casting characters as symbols of things. And by making Rune a symbol of absolute evil, I needed a symbol of absolute good. The history, the truth of it, of course, is that there are far more shades of gray in terms of the church of the era, in terms of the good it did and the evil it did.
Sure.
But for purposes of my comic, I could certainly pick a person of faith and cast them as someone that was absolutely good. So I created this character that I called the Crusader. And it's also because I was interested in Crusades and the psychology behind them and the era. I thought, well, it's a character that's kind of embodies the Crusader ideal, the high-minded Crusader ideal that I'm fighting, not just for myself, but for some higher thing, for a principle to try to bring about a better world. And in the 14th century, it was as evil a world as there could possibly be. So I thought, well, I'll have this character that represents good, but he won't be a Pollyanna. I'll make him wary because he's been on the front lines of fighting evil for centuries. He knows what a dubious mission it is to try to rid the world of evil, but he's still trying and he hasn't given up on the quest. And to me, that represents, you know, the highest expression of good.
That was the nuance to that character that I liked. There was a little bit of doubt about his ability to fulfill the quest. Never any real doubt about the quest itself, but I think you called into question his interpretation of the calling that he had.
Yeah, I left that open. I went and reread the issues last night, knowing we'd be talking about them today, and it's the second time I've read them in the last couple of years. I did look at them again for the blog. Yeah, and I do have the character Crusader. It's like he has a shipwreck on the way to the Holy Land or something, and he washes up on a shore, and he stumbles into a temple, and he sees this bright light, and he's given a quest. And he interprets it as, you know, he's on Mount Sinai. He's seeing a burning bush as far as he's concerned. I'm fuzzy on it, but the Ultraverse had this gigantic story Bible that was written by all the original founders of the Ultraverse, as well as Larry Niven. And yeah, Niven was one of the founders. He never wrote a book, but he did a lot of the original work on the series. And part of that, I'm sure, explains what that scene was. I just can't remember what it was anymore. There must have been some kind of singularity or energy or, you know, a alien being or something that was part of the firmament of the Ultraverse. And that's who that character was. It was inspiring, you know, filling our character with power. And our hero chose to interpret it as God. But that doesn't change his psychology at all. He's a person of faith. And as far as he's concerned, he's fighting for the true faith.
Exactly. I thought that one of the strengths of the issues was actually your prose. A lot of caption boxes, the narration, and that I thought was all good. Can you, you're a blogger, you're reviewing comics now. How objective do you think you can be about that, looking at that on your own work?
Well, I think I can be very objective. I'm trying to be very objective. First of all, thanks for the kind words. I did reread it last night. It was, you know, it's okay. It's better than I thought. It is overwritten as a comic book. I can get away with that a little bit.
It was the 90s, Paul.
Yes. But I mean, I can get away a little bit because of the subject, because, you know, the historical framing,
right.
And, you know, it lends itself to maybe a little bit wordier style of comics. But I'll tell you, the reason it's as wordy as it is was it was an expression of my frustration as a writer. And it's because I went through a series of phases as a comic book writer. At the beginning, just writing, not really knowing anything, figuring out anything as I was going, just getting in different results. Then going through a period in the middle part of my career when I was writing a lot, and I was doing 3 or 4 books a month, and I was thinking of myself as being in partners with artists. But I was a partnership with artists without being able to collaborate with them. So I'd send them a script, and I'd put a lot of detail in, please show this, please show this. And then I'd get the scripts back, and sometimes they were very good, but other times they weren't so good. And, you know, I'm able to look back on it now and realize that, hey, the pencilers were learning their craft too. You know, it was hard enough for me to write 8 pages a day. They're trying to draw 4 pages a day or something to make an acceptable rate. They're going really fast. So when I gave them a long description of something, and I had this image in my mind about what it was going to look like, and I get it back, and it's just a big head and a small box and a lot of word balloons. I'd be like, oh God, you know, this is, they missed it, right? So I kind of went back the other way and said, you know what, I can't trust artists to put down what I'm thinking, so I'm going to write what I'm thinking into the art. Now, that's not the right way to make a comic book. It's the right way to tell a story, maybe, if I was writing a short story as the approach. But comics would be better if there was a better union of the words and the art. One of my great regrets in working with Malibu is that I didn't get a chance to collaborate with artists, really. I couldn't sit down with them. There was no time. I never saw pages before it was time to balloon them. They were just always behind. So the guys would do the best they could, but more often than not, you were just trying to fix things and retrofit stuff and change stuff on the fly so that it corresponded with the art rather than making it better. There was no opportunity to iterate. So that these books are as overwritten as they are is an attempt to control the quality of the story, because I knew I couldn't control the art. And the art on these books is, yeah, it's good. They did the best they could. It wasn't, it's not great, but it's not terrible. It does the job. But I didn't know at the time I wrote it if I get great art or rotten art. So I thought, well, if you don't look at the art and just read the boxes, I'm going to make the boxes as best I can.
Now, this is something you've sort of mentioned earlier in our discussion here, but again, as I was reading that, and maybe a little overwritten, but it's a comic book. You know, I thought those technical aspects of the writing were really strong, which is evident on the blog. And again, sort of before or after the comic book phase of your career, did you consider or pursue other opportunities to write fiction, to write prose, be it short stories or other things? You said your kids have moved into that.
Yeah, they surely have. And they're better than I am at it because they do the work. You know, they sit there and they do their pages every day, whereas I'm more along the line. I can find reasons not to write.
That does make a difference, doesn't it?
Yeah, you have to do the work. So I've got files full of misfires and false starts. But nothing that I've brought to completion. No, the only complete work that I've published has been in the comic book form. For better or worse, that's where I've published, at least to date. Maybe things will change going forward. I do have some ambitions still to write, but the idea about writing being bound up in commerce, you write only what you can sell. You know, biting off a 24-page comic script is easier than saying, okay, I'm going to sit down and write a 100,000-word novel with no prospect of selling it. I've just never had that kind of dedication or craft to get through it. I've known people who have, and I admire them. Sure. I'd like to be one of them one day. So far, no dice.
To be fair and balanced, I will point out my one quibble that I had with the story.
Okay.
Only thing that struck me as a weakness that I noted this as I was reviewing the issues, was the handling of the character of Ione.
Yes.
And when we meet her, I thought, oh, how cool a character this could be. How did she become a squire? Were there many female squires? I was hoping for more of a story about her, and knowing more about her maybe would have made her death from the plague more potent.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know your reaction to that.
I think it's excellent feedback, and it comes 25 years too late.
Where was I then? I know.
Well, what you just did is you performed the role of an editor. Okay. Now, the editor on both these books was Roland Mand. Roland's a great guy. I like Roland. We're friends then. We still trade mail every once in a while. But Roland, like anybody else, was just bailing the swamp. You know, he's trafficking the books. He's making deadlines. And there was no opportunity for him to collaborate, interact with his creators any more than there was for me to interact with artists. So, I mean, that's the kind of objective point of view that an editor needs to bring to the process. I can tell you what happened with Ione. It's the same thing that happened with the character of the burger, who's also, you know, right, given short shrift in the story. Both those characters are plot puppets. It's really what they are. They exist in the story to advance the plot. Ione is there so that Crusader has someone to talk to, for one, so to get his expositional dialogue out, he has someone to talk to. And also so that it personifies the event that occurs in the second story, where the plague returns to the town and we have to show how horrible this is. So we're going to kill someone that you kind of know. It's not just some faceless person. With Ione, I'm sure when I first wrote the character, it's probably just the disposable male squire. So by making it female, I was trying to give the character a little depth and intrigue a reader. And I'm glad I did, somebody. And also, comics, you know, you're always trying to sell comics. So if you can make the character female and sex it up a little bit, you do that. That didn't come across in the art or the way the character was shown, but I'm sure that was probably part of the impulse as well. It ended up raising questions. Yeah, you're right. I mean, you know, what's the story of this female squire? It's kind of interesting. Yeah, it does imply that there's some story. The character Crusader is he seems indulgent of her a little bit, sort of like, well, you're not actually a squire. I'm kind of doing this for your benefit. If these stories had taken off and if my comic career continued, maybe I'd be able to return and figure that out. But these were very nearly the last comics I ever wrote, I think. Certainly they were the last ones published by Malibu. I flatter myself that they were published by Marvel, because these books, they came out after the Malibu Marvel acquisition. And I recall my check had Marvel Comics on it when I cashed it. So, hey, I made it.
I was going to ask you that. It did look like, according to the comic book DB, that this was your last published comic work. Is that about your memory?
There was one more. It was published in, I want to say, 2005.
Oh, wow.
And it was in support of a video game that I made called Dark Watch, made a vampire Western, a character of Jericho Cross, the vampire gunslinger of the Old West, who's a lot like Rune, very similar guy. And I was a co-creator of that character along with Mr. Chris Alm, who was a co-creator of Rune. So you can figure out what that etymology was. So we created this character, Jericho Cross, for a video game called Dark Watch, which was published by Capcom and Ubisoft around 2007 or whatever on PlayStation 2 and Xbox. We created a comic book to go along with it that was published in Heavy Metal magazine, and that came out about 2005. I think it was called Dark Watch Innocence was the name of it. It's a piece of hooey, frankly. In fact, I found it. Here it is. Yeah, it's Heavy Metal magazine. This is history. This shows that I've actually mastered my comic book collection because I found it. The July 2005 edition of Heavy Metal magazine. So that was the last comic I wrote. Go find that in a dollar box, Professor. I challenge you.
I think that one's going to be a struggle.
I was blessed to be able to write these things. I was blessed to be able to create for a living for a while, to have, you know, I've given my collaborators, my pencilers, my editors a little bit of a hard time for not being able to collaborate, but it wasn't because they didn't want to, it's just because they couldn't. And those guys were all doing the best they could too. It really was a rare opportunity, and it's taken me decades to recognize how rare an opportunity it was. So right. To have an opportunity to kind of talk about it, you know, that's a precious thing too. That's good. Because I got attention when I wrote the books. I had, you know, some magazine interviews and this and that. There wasn't an internet. There wasn't a community. There was no way to talk to readers. There's no way to get anybody's feedback on anything. So to get that even all these years later is still, that's a good thing. It's a precious thing. So I appreciate that. Thank you.
Well, again, tell us about the blog and how listeners can get in touch with you in the various social medias.
Oh yeah. Well, if you want to find me on social media, just throw a rock, right? And like they say in Barton Fink, throw it hard.
Go to Pinterest and type in mail, and you'll come up.
If you open up Google and you type Long Box Graveyard, you will find me. The father of the waters for all my social media is the blog, which is www.longboxgraveyard.com. There's always something there. I'm also on Twitter as LBox Graveyard. You can find me on Facebook. I'm on Pinterest, other places too, Tumblr. But best place to find me is on the blog. People can post there the reactions to any stories, old or new. I'm 300 articles there or something, but they're all new to me. And I love it when, like as you did when you did your read through, I love it when people comment on stuff that I wrote a couple years ago, because it brings it back to life and I get to talk about it. Right. So people can comment there, of course. They can email me at the blog. My email address is longboxgraveyard@gmail.com. Not that hard to remember. Always eager to interact with people. The blog is primarily about Bronze and Silver Age comics, and about, not necessarily about the comics so much as about what they meant to the people who read them. One of my catchphrases is that the golden age of everything is 12. It's not unique to me, but I found that to be the case. More often than not, people sit them in print on things when they're 12, 13 years old. So I bring people in to do guest blogs as well. Tell me what you liked when you were 12. You know, and they'll write about the Punisher, or they'll write about, you know, whoever, characters that didn't mean as much to me. So there's lots of different voices of the blog. It's not just mine. But mostly we talk about Bronze and Silver Age books because we're of a certain age and that's what we imprint on. But I'm, you know, happy to chat about any kind of comics. Here's a scoop for the Quarterbox podcast. My family and I are very seriously looking at moving into a substantially smaller house. Talking about giving up half our square footage, giving up the garage. So the Longbox Graveyard collection itself, that may be bound for, well, hopefully not for the ash can, but for collectors someplace that appreciate it. So I'm entertaining offers for people that want to buy comics. It may be time to say goodbye to it. But if I do end up selling those books, it'll be with my head up, you know, feeling that I explored them and reconciled myself with them and collected them. And I have intentionality in giving them up, as opposed to just being defeated by this big pile of books that I never came to terms with. So maybe it's time. That's the story yet untold, and it will be told at the blog over the next 6 months to the year.
Right. Thanks for joining us here, Paul. Really appreciate it.
It was my pleasure, Professor. Thanks so much. And, you know, happy to come back and chat about this trivia anytime.
Well, that wraps up my interview with comic blogger and recovering comic book scribe, Paul O'Connor, bringing episode 30 of the Quarterbin podcast to a close. In episode 31, I'll be looking at Doctor Strange Sorcerer Supreme number 33 from Marvel Comics, cover dated September 1991. If you have any comments or questions about this interview or the podcast, feel free to contact me. Until next time, I'm Professor Allen, and I'll see you in the Quarterbin. The Quarterbin Podcast is part of the Relatively Geeky family of podcasts. Show notes and links are available at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com, where the podcasts Uncovering the Bronze Age and Short Box Showcase also make their home. Links to Facebook and Twitter are there as well. Feedback for the show is welcome at relativelygeeky@gmail.com. And if you like what we've got going here, please leave a review and a rating in iTunes. It'll help more people discover the show. Thanks again for listening.